Have you ever noticed that these stained glass windows that surround us in this beautiful church look a lot nicer from the inside of the church than they do from the outside? That's an apt metaphor, I think, for the experience that I have had, and I suspect many of you have had in the past several weeks. I have many friends from many places. Some of my friends are deep people of faith for whom the truth of religion, of Catholic Christianity, is the vital pulse of their lives. And then I have friends who are what we charitably call Seventh-day Horizontalists, people for whom faith is an utter mystery, and an unwelcome one at that. In the past several weeks, we have had that tension between how people of faith make their way in the world versus the claims of the secular society and demands, more prominently in the news than we're used to. My Facebook feed is filled either with exuberance of approval at recent Supreme Court decisions or utter outrage and vitriol. There's no in-between ground, apparently. Nonetheless, for me, as what I hope to be a reasonable person of faith, it begs me to ask one particular question. Why do some people get it and some people don't? Why were the first disciples gathered around Jesus, and yet the message of Jesus was a hard sell for many folks in the area? Why were the Jewish Christians who were gathered around the Apostle Matthew at odds with those Jews who didn't recognize truth in Jesus? Why are we gathered here today when many of our neighbors are sleeping in, or riding a bike on the Swamp Rabbit, or enjoying a lazy morning? Why do some people get this and some people don't? It's an age-old question that in theological terms is understood as election, a sense that there is much about the faith that can only be understood by those who have been elected or are elected to be inside the community of Christ. While there are so many who have chosen not to be inside the community, the church, and thus there are those who reap the benefits of being inside, of gazing at the beauty that structures our lives, while there are so many who do not. And this topic is, of course, the choice of Jesus for his first parable, at least as recorded in the Gospel of Matthew. And despite the interpretive challenges of parables in general, this one is perhaps the most trite, the most cliche, the most easy to interpret. It doesn't require knowledge of first century Palestinian farming practices to make sense. It doesn't really leave a whole lot to the imagination in the basic interpretation. Jesus even tells us who are represented by three of the four soil types. In some ways, this kind of text is the hardest to preach on because there's so little for the preacher to exaggerate or nuance in the search for a contemporary application and understanding. It is what it is, and it offers us an idea of why some people get it and some people don't. Why we are here and many of our neighbors are not. Why faith is an organizing principle in our lives and not necessarily in those of others. The parable's clear about the reasons why some don't get it. There are those whose faith has fallen into the clutches of an evil one, the evil one, snatched away. There are those who are too shallow to endure the trouble of the world. And there are those whose concerns for worldly matters and wealth lure them away so that the seed yields nothing. There's not a great interpretive challenge to the parable, and yet I think we are left with many questions. One of the things we do know is that this parable, this story, would not have been unknown to the first people who heard Jesus say it or who heard Matthew report it. In the sort of the pop culture of the time, if you will, there was another account of the same story that's found in a book called Second Esdras, which is a non-canonical book in Hebrew scriptures. And in this particular account in Second Esdras, the prophet Ezra prays to God to not look at the sins of the many, but rather at those who act righteously and heroically. Ezra does something rather interesting. He intersperses these confessions of sin with pleas for mercy. And in that creates a tension that we as Christians know very well, the understanding that all sin, and yet there is righteousness in the world. In 2 Esdras, God responds to Ezra's prayer with a shortened form of this parable of the sower, a statement that not all that are sown will come up, not all that are planted will take root. And in this story, the prophet Ezra does exactly what I think so many of us want to do when we are talking with God. He comes back with questions, a sort of not so fast, Almighty. Let's work a little bit on this plan. Ezra objects that what is at stake here isn't just the farmer's seeds, but rather humans, created and formed in God's own image and set into the world that was made for them. Surely, Ezra seems to ask God, as humans are God's special creatures, endowed with memory, reason, and skill, made in his image and likeness and with God's own chosen people, surely there is more to our faith and ultimate salvation than the random chance of where seeds have fallen onto the ground. Surely our relationship with God is not condemned or cultivated simply by random chance. In 2 Esdras, God tells Ezra not to pretend that Ezra is more concerned about creation than God is. Basically, God says, don't get above your pay grade. To stop worrying about the future and to worry less about the punishment of the wicked and more about the salvation of the righteous. And here I think that many of us echo this dialogue as we understand, if only because we've been told in this parable as well, what causes the seeds of faith to fail. But we are still left wondering about how we ensure that the seeds fall into good ground. How do we as individuals and a community nourish the ground of our faith to ensure good development? How do we get it even as others do not? We recognize that in all things, and especially in something so marked by love as faith, that there are risks. Some won't prosper despite their hopes, and some won't want to. Yet there is still the bigger question before us. In the colloquial, we might ask not why some get it, some understand, some believe, and some don't, but what is there in fact to get? In theological terms, we might ask the question differently, but with the same meaning, we might ask, how do we who are formed of the earth and who shall return to the dust, just as the seed of the parable, how do we transcend the earthly limitations of biological existence to share in the life of God and enjoy his presence for eternity? In terms of the parable, how do we stop worrying about the seed and the dirt and focus on the mystery of life? It seems to me that we are left with nothing less and nothing more than the grace of God and the promise of the Holy Spirit. And if that seems like an answer that is as trite and cliche as the parable of the sower, we do well to remember that all life, even that of the incarnation of Jesus Christ, happened through the grace of God, the promise of the Holy Spirit, and the willingness of a human to listen and obey. We know that there are personal issues, like those found in the parable of worldly concern, of evil presence, or simply shallowness, that prevent the Spirit working to amend the soil of our lives. However, we also know that there are no such personal issues that can compel the Spirit to be present to us. It is simply our ability to be open to the working of God in our lives that enables seeds planted to grow, to flourish, and to fruit. And so the question of why some get it and some don't, indeed the question even of what there is to get, cannot be answered without an understanding that all life flows through the graces of the Spirit. And we become more than a bundle of biology and random chance when we acknowledge the simple fact of our creation. Some of us become more open to the Spirit through suffering, through our own or those of others. Some of us are more open to the Spirit through community and communion. Some become more open to the Spirit simply through the gut instinct that there is more to this world than we can see or comprehend. But in the end of all of our analysis, in the end of all of our theology, we can do no more to prepare the soil of our lives for the seeds of faith than to pray, "Come, Holy Spirit, fill the hearts of your faithful and kindle in them the fire of your love. Send forth your Spirit, and they shall be created, and you shall renew the face of the earth."